Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Tonight we deal with a sensitive subject, something we all have probably encountered at one time or another, friends or family. Subject of suicide. We're going to be assessing suicide risk with the professor of epidemiology in psychiatry at UMKC, Dr. Stanley Edlovich. We'll have our usual introduction and he'll talk about the subject for tonight's show and then take a short break, and then we'll come back for a short question and answer period with the audience. This program was recorded on Sunday, April 26th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. So let's go to the introduction and we'll proceed with our show tonight.
Well, good morning. Welcome to the forum. My name is Craig Volland. I'm a member of the forum committee. This morning, we really have a great program. We have Dr. Stanley Edlovich. He is professor of epidemiology in the Department of Psychiatry at UMKC School of Medicine. He was formerly on the governor's Mental Health Advisory Council for Kansas, and he is on the Kansas City Suicide Awareness and Prevention Program, where he is chairman of the board. Dr. Edlovich has a master's in public health and a master's degree in mathematical statistics from the University of Missouri Columbia, and he also has a PhD in epidemiology from the University of California in Berkeley. Very interestingly, he has spent quite a bit of time in China and is an adjunct professor at a medical center there. Still maintains contact there and has been there a number of times. So he has a very broad experience in his field. And so I give you Dr. Edlovich.
Thank you very much. I don't know, do you all know what an epidemiologist is? Because some people do and some people don't. Okay? Epidemiologist is the field where you learn the techniques of science to study diseases in populations and try to figure out what's going on and to develop public health programs to intervene. Everybody knows about Ebola, knows about the flu, the infectious diseases, you know about coronary heart disease, a bunch of epidemiologic stuff. So I always talk about it that I'm a guy with a hammer, but I need somebody that has the nails. In other words, I don't claim to be an expert in every field I've worked in because I collaborate with people that have studied most diseases you can think of. I've helped them do studies. I know how to design studies, how to do statistics, but if it's psychology, psychiatry, I rely on somebody like Professor Boutros here, who's chairman of our department now, to provide the expertise in that. So I'm going to tell you the part of it I know a little bit and try to introduce some concepts. And I asked, first of all, this is work I've been doing. We'll talk a little bit about the work I've been doing with Dr. Bill Geis, who's a clinical psychologist in town. He's very well known in the field of suicidology. He's trained recently in the last year or two over 2,000 clinicians in techniques for suicide assessment and treatment. And Dr. Fred Newman is part of this community, who is a biometrician and a psychologist who works with us, who has tremendous expertise in how you analyze data and how you praise different issues. And then finally, I asked Bill Art. Bill, would you stand up to be here? Bill was chair, I've been on both the Missouri and Kansas Governor's Advisory Committees, but Bill was chairman of the Kansas Advisory Committee, what, for 4 or 5 years, weren't you? 10 years, he was, well, officer or chairman for 10 years. He just stepped down as chair of that committee. Bill also was, you can sit down. He was also Johnson County Community Mental Health Center. He was a major clinician there, as well as the person who, because he speaks fluent Spanish, the person who was doing all the Hispanic counseling, or half of it anyway, they had somebody else, but he was doing the Hispanic counseling there. And I asked Bill to be here today because I didn't know Nash would be here. If there's a question that comes up, or something that comes up in this presentation that you really feel you need to talk to somebody, I'm not the guy. I told you, I'm the researcher. Bill is a clinician. He has done a lot of the referrals in town. He's not looking for business, by the way. He's busy as can be. What he's here for is a resource for you if somebody needs it. Okay? So please feel free either to ask the question, or afterwards Bill said he'd stay for a few minutes if you want to talk to somebody for a few minutes about anything that's on your mind. You're not going to be able to see some of the little numbers here, there, and the other place, so I'm going to describe what's on these slides. They're there just to give you an idea of what's going on. We have been talking about the importance of suicide in the United States, and actually worldwide. You can see, if you can see the number at the beginning, it's 1981. And if you look at that slide, and you look at the rates going to 2013, we haven't made a lot of progress. So that's what, as a public health person, what concerns me. Why haven't we made a lot of progress? I don't have a pointer here, so let me just tell you what that blue line is. That blue line is people 45 to 64. And what we've noticed recently is a major increase in suicide rates in people of middle age. Some of those lines that are going up are the elderly, but then the other thing that's really disturbing is that thing right in the middle that's at the 10, because that's the teenagers, the young people. And there have been major programs trying to intervene with young people. And again, instead of showing what we'd hope to see, which is a decrease, as you can see there, we're seeing either a sharp increase in some age groups or a gradual increase in others. Typically, it goes like this. Women attempt suicide more than men, but men complete suicide more than women. And people think, to some extent, this is because of the way people try to attempt suicide that do it. You can see here on this slide that about half the people that complete suicide use a firearm, and that's mostly men. So somebody that sticks a gun in their mouth or to their head and pulls the trigger is much more successful than somebody who takes a bunch of pills or does something else. And that's why there's one theory, that's why it shows up. I didn't make a slide of it. Interestingly enough, the highest rates in the world at one point, and I think they've gone down some, were in rural China. And it was women in rural China. And it turned out what these women were doing, it was similar to this whole idea with the gun. They had in the home, they all had tons of pesticides because there was a very rural area and they were using it on their farms. So these women, instead of like here, where they might take a prescription drug or over-the-counter drug, they were using the pesticides, and the pesticides were lethal. So the rates were off the wall. They were very high. Interestingly enough, the Chinese government insisted that the pesticide manufacturers put them in unit doses. In other words, instead of giving a gallon, they'd have to give 4-ounce containers or something like that, or 3-ounce containers, and make a little bit safer pesticides. And the rates start to drop because it became much harder to open up a dozen of them. But when somebody could just drink the pesticide, it was really easy for somebody to decide to commit suicide. So 41,000 deaths a year due to suicide in the US. Even though it's the 10th leading cause of death you saw on that slide, that's a lot of people that are committing suicide. And as I said before, we've shown from those graphs we looked at that for a while it looked like things were decreasing, but they really haven't. They've sort of gone back up. In The U.S., once every 13 minutes, somebody completes a suicide. Our efforts locally for the last, this is going back to the early 80s, our efforts locally have been around youth and schools for a long time, because we were really disturbed by that line you saw in one of those earlier slides, where the youth rates continue to rise. And where in youth, it's the, you don't see some of the reasons you see in older people. It should be preventable. Now, not every suicide is going to be preventable, but it should be preventable. And what's interesting is in youth, more teenagers die of suicide than just about everything else combined. Accidents come out a little higher, but it's just unacceptable. So we've tried to work on programs that are going to intervene. And that's, I was introduced as chairman of KCSAP, Kansas City Suicide Awareness and Prevention Program. And what our work has been with school districts to try to introduce programs into schools. And if, at the end, there'll be a few slides that have how to contact us. And if you have any interest in working in the community, this is non-paid, nothing else. But if you have any interest in working in that area, let me know, and we'll be happy to get you involved. What this shows is that essentially 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, those numbers are pretty consistent going across, aren't they? You see the male-female difference in attempts. The more females attempt here. And there was some, at one point people said it didn't affect all racial groups. And even, this is a national survey, it's done by CDC in the schools, by the way. And you can see that it shows up in all racial groups there. And the highest has been in American, Native Indians, Native Americans, I guess is the correct term, or Hispanic subpopulations. And people can have all kinds of ideas why that might occur. I had a student once who walked into my office. This is how I got involved in the field. Student walked into my office who was working on a thesis, and they gave me the draft of the thesis. And it said that in the 8th grade and 9th grade, this says 13%. In that population, it might have been a little higher. They said, there's 15%, 20% of the kids had said they had thought about committing suicide last year. And 10% said they made an attempt. 1 in 10 kids. And I looked at that and I said, that's nonsense. That has to be wrong. You must have done something wrong. And then we found out by going to the national studies, going to other cities where they had similar surveys, that that was correct. 1 in 10 kids in high school say they've attempted suicide in the last year. So we decided that that was the area we were going to concentrate in. That's how we got involved in all this. At the beginning, I didn't believe it, but it apparently turns out consistently, and Bill knows the data better than I do. That's pretty accurate, isn't it? Yeah, okay. If you look the other way, and you go and you take people who have actually completed suicide, not everybody's depressed. So you can't just say because people are depressed, they're going to decide to commit suicide. 2/3 of the people, or approximately 2/3 of the people who actually complete suicide when they do what is a psychological autopsy, when they try to figure out what was going on in the past, they have some episode of depression or mood problems or something is identified, but 1/3 don't. If you go in the other direction, you find that there's a whole issue with who gets treated and who gets the care. We're going to be talking about this a little bit more in a minute. Half of Americans claim they've had major depressive episode and do get treatment, but half claim they don't. The good news is that people like Nash and people like Bill have really made a lot of progress in treating depression. So if somebody gets to a trained therapist, there's a lot more success today than there was 10, 15 years ago. So we're doing better at treatment, but we need to get people to, it's called destigmatizing. Got people to accept that I might need some assistance, and if I need assistance, it's okay to go and ask for help. And then the issue is, there has to be enough people that are trained to help them. Because if they go to ask for help, that somebody's not trained, they go to somebody like me, they're not gonna get any place. They have to go to somebody like these guys who know what they're doing. So we have to have enough people trained that know what they're doing that we can really make a difference. I thought you might be interested in knowing about Jackson County, Johnson County, Wyandotte County, just some feel for, is this an issue here? If you saw that the overall U.S. is about 12 per 100,000 is the death rate on the national average, and you take a look here, Jackson County, Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, it's high overall. And it's not only high overall one year, this is over between 2007 and 2013. It's high in each time period, about 15.8 or 15.6, something like that, per 100,000 is the rate. Wyandotte County is very similar. The 2011-13, I don't know why that's lower, it could be a reporting issue, because I think the latest statistics are back up for Wyandotte. So very similar. Johnson County actually is a little better. It's not wonderful, but it's a little bit better. But it's still above what the national averages are. So this came out from Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. And got Bill Geis, as I said, is the psychologist who's been driving a lot of our work. Stuart Monroe, also a psychiatrist from the department, who preceded Nash as chair of the department of psychiatry, is one of our colleagues. And this sort of turned people on. This Detroit, Henry Ford Hospital, had these very high number of suicides for years. And they took an approach which they call a zero suicide approach. And it essentially, I'm gonna be talking about in detail in a few minutes, but essentially what they said is that you have to train the clinicians. You have to ask people if they're having problems. You have to deal with crises. You have to provide services. You have to have a whole system. You can't just have a piece of a system. You have to understand, and what I'm going to talk about a little bit of our work, on thought processes, because you have to deal with what the individual needs. You can't put people in a black box and say they belong in a black box. You have to understand what's going on with them. And lo and behold, now it's going back up. They have a few suicides now. But they got down to zero. They put a lot of energy, a lot of resources, but in a way it saves lives, it saves money in the long run, and they really prevented suicide. And this really got us started on this initiative that's going on locally. You can't read that, and it's not that important that you read it, but it says that to do this, it has to be a systems approach. There has to be administrative buy-in, and people have to put resources into it. There has to be a philosophy that it's okay to ask for help and to provide help. People have to agree that they want to be trained. And essentially, when somebody comes in and says, they may be having a problem, that they're taken seriously. Somebody listens to them, takes it seriously, and tries to assist them in dealing with them, getting them to the right place, just doesn't send them home with a pill and say, come back in a month, type of thing. So it's really a systems approach. That's really the point. I'm not, again, I just said this basically, But one of the things up at the top, and that's what that next slide has to deal with, is that you have to know who you're seeing and you have to listen to them. And one of the things we learned is, if you see, this was one of the initiatives. This is, happens to be a Native American initiative. But these kids decided what their message is to get to the other kids. And that's what we found in our local community as well. When we did stuff for the kids, they made up the posters. And what they put on the posters, we wouldn't have put on the posters, but the kids looked at them. So you have to really, so here, you know, this is a standard message when you're looking at these programs, essentially saying that suicide does not end the chances of life getting worse. It eliminates the possibility of it ever getting better. But the kids made that up. This wasn't a bunch of adults saying, do this. And they went out and tried to get this Native American kids to listen to them. There's a bunch of misconceptions about suicide, and I'm watching time, so I'm not going to go through all these. One of the misconceptions is that people, if you interrupt somebody from committing suicide, they're going to do it tomorrow anyway. And that's not necessarily true. There's a really interesting, there we go, really interesting study that was done in Houston. There's 153 people that attempted suicide, but for one reason or other weren't successful. These were serious attempts. This wasn't just crying out for help. And you can see that most of them made a quick decision after a long time of thinking about it. And what people have found is that if you can give people tools to deal with a crisis, that time for a lot of them passes and they don't make that decision. So I'll tell you two stories to explain this a little better. One is the guy by the name of Kevin Hines, who actually jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and survived. And he talks around the country. This is not me, you know, no HIPAA thing here. He talks around the country about his episode. And he said he was standing there getting ready to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, and he only wanted somebody to come over and ask him how he was. He should have seen how distraught he was. And nobody came over. And then some tourists came over and asked him to take their picture. And he stopped and he took their picture. And they still didn't ask him, because he's standing there getting ready to jump off the bridge. And he jumped off the bridge. And he said, as soon as he went over the side, he said, I don't want to be doing this, but he's already jumping off the bridge. He said, if he gets up, a very powerful speaker, if anybody would have even said, good morning, how you doing, not just take my picture, it would have been enough to intervene for him at that point. So, you know, there is a matter of this. We had a guy who was working with us he moved out to Colorado, but worked with us for years and was doing education in the schools. And he tells a similar story. He was standing, and he tried to commit suicide. He was standing at the water fountain at school, and he was popping pills. And he said he was standing there 10 minutes popping pills, and nobody said anything to him. And finally, and he had been saying stuff in class about how distraught he was. Nobody listened to him. And finally, some teacher looked over and asked him if something was wrong. And that's what saved his life. And he's very powerful as he goes into schools and he talks to kids about how, if you can just break this pattern a little bit, how it's everybody's responsibility to help each other. And that's part of this church, I think. The whole philosophy here too, isn't it? So now I'm finally going to get to what we're doing a little bit. What we've tried to do is we've tried to say that there's a bunch of people out there that have tried to understand the thought patterns of people who get into distress and what leads one person who has a distressful life, who has factors going on that might make them consider taking their own lives. actually go that next step of the way versus another person. And this fits into, and I'll try to in one of these pictures demonstrate that, this fits into that whole approach of the zero suicide, the systems approach. This is just a piece of it. We're not, this isn't the whole thing. This is just a piece that you get a better understanding so the therapist knows where to help the person. And there are eight thought constructs, which I'll briefly go over. And then there are some things that are protective mediators and some things that are clinical mediators. In other words, as you build a model, you can understand better by asking the right questions. And that's the research. I'm going to put this up. I'm going to list the things. And if somebody wants to know what they are, I actually have definitions, but I think it'll take too long to go through each one. Loathsomeness is essentially hating oneself, self-hatred. So just explain what that is. Unbearability, life is unbearable. Suicide decisions, failure, despair, demoralized, distress, burdensome, thwartedness, belongingness. People are isolated, don't have any support structure. Hopelessness, people seem to intuitively understand that. So what we've tried to do is in training clinicians to tell them they have to understand this level of risk. They have to understand these factors, but they also have to take into account whether there's an imminent risk or not an imminent risk. And if it's an imminent risk, they have to get people to the care that they need, not to postpone getting them to care. And it's important to initiate targeted care, because if you understand what the thought processes are, then you know how to target to help the person. And each person has their own parameters. I overdid it. I'm looking at, and I apologize to you guys, I've put in here a number of terms and explanations of what this is all about. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave it to questions, because there are these various theorists who've come up with these concepts of what might be driving people to go beyond normal life and make an attempt. And the sort of the father of the field was this guy by the name of Schneiderman, who started with saying it's psychache. And he defined psychache as the pain of excessively felt shame or guilt or humiliation. Okay, so, but then what we've done is we've brought all these people together, all these concepts together into this model to see how they apply and how they interact with each other. And that's the research we've been doing. Aaron Beck is another one. He did the hopelessness, and I won't go through each slide like that. There's a woman out in California, not in California, in Washington, in Seattle, Marsha Linehan, who says reasons for living or for dying, but reasons for living are protective. And somebody who can, if somebody has family, if they say, I wouldn't do that to my son, all of a sudden you have a set of protective factors that might help. There's a guy in Florida who says that people who make these multiple attempts sort of get immune to hurting themselves. So eventually they might consider making a lethal attempt. I mentioned burdensomeness before, belongingness, self-loathing, the tortured mentation. That picture's a pity that picture can't be on the radio, because that picture really does demonstrate tortured mentation. Doesn't everybody can understand it just looking at this poor guy sitting there. So with Fred's help, what we've done is we've taken all these thought patterns that these people have studied them. They haven't just come up with some concept. They've gone out in populations, they've studied people, they said this really applies. But as you saw from those statistics, even though they've had some success in places, we haven't been able to lower the rates. So what we've tried to do is we've tried to take this and put it together and say, can you understand better what people are going through and what factors might drive them, what might be protective and what might be more harmful, so that you're giving the clinician if not a menu, a prescription of the way of what is affecting that particular individual. And what we've used is for our outcome importance, remember I said earlier that we want to know if everybody that walked in, if 1/4 of the kids in school say they have problems, which they do, if everybody walked in and said, I want to see a psychologist or psychiatrist tomorrow, you couldn't do it. We don't have enough people to be treating everybody in the world, because everybody has some problems. We all, I don't know, you guys may be perfect, but the rest of us have problems. So the real thing is to try to come up with an assessment that also tells you how fast you need to intervene, how fast you help the person. So we're using acute risk of suicide as our main outcome, because that's the one that we want to prevent most to start with, right? And I said we've taken the, and I, this is a picture that Bill shows all the time, and this is due to your colleague, Fred. And essentially, what we're doing is we're taking all these things and we're correlating them, and it's just a picture that shows that you go through all these correlations to come up with a model that tells us that it really works. That's the great thing about it. That's the bottom line. It works. You can put these constructs together, you can learn from all these smart people, and you can come up with a model that appears to be a better predictor. And that's what we've been trying to do in our research. We've been fortunate. The Healthcare Foundation of Greater Kansas City has been very generous over, oh boy, I can't remember when we started with them, maybe 98, but they've been very generous over a series of years to support this work. And we're hoping, eventually we want to go one more round, and then we're hoping to go to NIH and try to get money. Because what we really want to do is provide a better set of tools for clinicians. This picture, it doesn't matter, you don't need to read the little blocks, but what it says essentially is that we have to do this assessment as part of a systematic approach. That's all it says. That's really what the point of that is. And it's the same thing here. This goes into a little more detail, but again, it says it's part of a systematic approach. It's not just a one-off thing. It's just not filling out a set of forms. I just wanted to mention this. In the last week, and I don't know much about this yet. Have you looked into this yet? In the last week, SAMHSA just unveiled, or just came out with this. And they're coming out with a tool for clinicians, which is very similar to what I described. It's not exactly the same thing. And we have to see how much it overlaps with what we're doing. It's not exactly the same assessment, but they were so concerned that people, if you go in the community, and we had a little survey we thought about doing here, but if you go in the community, you find that half of the people will say, I had some type of major episode in the last year that had me concerned. And someplace, depending on where you go, from 15 to 25% of people will say, I considered committing suicide. Now, whether they considered it seriously or not, that's another issue, but I considered committing suicide. And 10 to 15% of people say, I attempted suicide. And if you go into high schools, which is the data I know intimately, more than 10% of the kids say, I attempted suicide. And not only that, in the high schools, when you ask them, you attempted suicide, what did you do if you attempted suicide? And you do it in a way that you're looking to validate that they're not just saying this to, you know. You find that their answers are all consistent. They're telling you what they believe is the truth. And that's not acceptable to me. Because I want to see those rates be going down. And the way you do that is you get everybody involved. And there's programs now that are oriented to get everybody involved from at a minimal level just to identify when a friend or colleague needs some assistance, a program called Assist in particular, mental health first aid, just to help in general people learn a little bit so they know when to help one of their friends or colleagues and how to help them get care, to programs like the one that Bill is doing, where he's training clinicians with tools to do crisis intervention, to do this kind of assessment I just described, to understand thought patterns, to understand interventions. By the way, you notice I didn't mention drugs, because we're really trying to understand the processes. Obviously, pharmaceuticals come in at times, but that's not what this is all about. And I promised I'd finish now, so I'm hoping there are questions or comments or stuff I can't answer, Bill Nash can answer.
You've been listening to Dr. Stanley Edlovich. He's been talking about suicide. We owe you a few messages. Let's take a break. You're listening to the All Souls Forum right here on KKFI.
Let me make a 10-second commercial. Veterans and military have a rate of 22 rather than 13. The crisis line, 1-800-273-TALK, hit number one. You will get into the veterans line in Canandaigua, New York, and we will hop on them. After 50 years of treating people who are suicidal, I've come to the conclusion that what one needs is reasons for living. What have you guys done in terms of reasons for living sorts of things in your studies as protective factors?
Yeah, and Fred knows this about it better than I do. I may ask him to answer the question, but what we found is that reasons for living definitely are important in terms of improving or lowering the imminent risk. So if you take the same thought pattern, which in one person or one group of people might put somebody at higher risk, and then people have a higher set of reasons for living, you find that the risk goes down. So you're absolutely correct. It doesn't eliminate risk, but it definitely makes a difference. And let me make another comment and say thank you for bringing up the thing about the veterans. We've actually been talking to the veteran hospitals about doing similar work, and there's been some interest. PTSD is a major problem, and some of the thoughts are that some of this increase in some of these age groups may be the returning veterans, because you know what we're having is we're having the veterans come back from these different theaters. The only other thing to say about that is that some of the highest rates in the military are the people that never got deployed. And I don't know what the answer is. Why that is? Why is that?
Break up a relationship far more than combat.
You think that's what it is?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I didn't know. But it's interesting. The people that don't get deployed have a high rate of suicide attempts. There's, if you're interested in the area, there's a guy, he's now the dean of something or other at, in Memphis, help me, what's the school there? What would be the major medical school? Anyway, in Memphis, he was in Texas, then he went to Utah by the name of David Rudd, and they have done work with the VA and the military, and they've come up with a shortened set of cognitive behavioral therapy interventions that seems to be working. So it's worth looking into if you're interested in that area. Sorry.
My concern is with the 14 to 16 year old approximate group and the effect, if there is a copycat effect, sympathetic effect, and I hate to use the word fad, that's too flip, but tight groups of kids who see their peers attempting and the attention it gathers, or the simple sympathy or seeing of a likeness between the friend and themselves and acting on that with a suicide attempt. Is that a reality, or is that just another parental grandmotherly worry?
Well, I'm going to ask one of our psychologists to answer that part of it, but I can tell you that one of the concerns that people raise all the time is that we were going to do a survey here. We decided not to do it because of time. But one of the, that asking people about their suicide intentions, about their thoughts, would increase the rate of suicide in that group, would disturb people. We found that we interviewed 1,000 people for our studies. And of the 1,000 people, we had 3 or 4 people who said that it made them feel worse. Nobody tried to commit suicide after being asked the questions, by the way, but made them feel worse. Most people thanked us for asking the questions because they said, nobody ever asked us. And most of the research shows that going out and doing these programs in communities with young people, that it actually, they don't get any negative effects. The research that's evaluated it shows they don't. I don't know about the copycats. Do one of you guys know anything about copycats? I don't know enough about copycats. Do you, Fred?
It has a small effect, interacting effect, with self-hatred and belongingness, so the issue of relationship comes in there. It's not a major thing, but it's there, and it's something the clinician needs to check off.
But if you send me an email, you have my email from up there? We'll look into it, because I really don't know the data on copycats, and I hate to give you the wrong answer on copycats.
We had a variable called peer influence.
Oh, okay, so this is a small effect. But I still don't know the literature, and it bothers me.
Hi, my question is has to do with the older age group that you were talking about, right. The rates going up. The constructs that you put up on the screen would seem that it would detour people from seeking help. And then that sort of led me to wonder if you track those people who don't have health care, who don't have access to, you know, a clinician. Do you track that? I mean, do we know how many of these people are sort of out in limbo and they would have to go through extraordinary means to really even?
Your question is valid.
Okay.
Our work so far, because of funding issues, has been in people, it's a group of people that have had access to safety net services mostly, but have had access to care. So the issue of non-access to care has to be real, but we haven't studied that group yet. We have had homeless people in our group, as well as people who are not homeless, et cetera, but these people have gotten to care because that's where we interviewed them. So, and they were covered at that level, yeah. Sorry.
What is a big issue, I think, with the opiate use? You know, it's prescribed or street, you know, acquired, I guess. But you guys deal with that issue. I mean, you're saying you're not doing that much with substance abuse.
In our population, in the population of 1,000 people we studied, there was some drug use, there was some alcoholism, et cetera, but it wasn't a driving factor. That doesn't mean it's not a driving factor in some populations. But and as you know, the whole issue with opiate use today is extremely controversial. And if you take a look, you're going to see on the one hand that there were, I've forgotten the numbers, so I don't want to quote it wrong, there were a large number of opiate overdose deaths or emergency room visits that were just reported, I think it was the New York Times. It was just in the news in the last week. And people are concerned about that. And on the other hand, the people in the pain community are concerned because there's been a trend from treating people in chronic pain correctly to now clinicians being beat up if they give too many opiates, and it goes back and forth. So it's a very complex issue. In our population, we studied over 1,000 people in Kansas City for this research, and that was not a driving factor, though. So it wasn't in our population. It's a valid question, but we didn't study.
And thanks.
Thank you.
Since the early 2000s, hospitals and doctor's offices that receive Medicare Medicaid funding have been required to screen for suicide. I couldn't help but notice on your graph that during that period in time, we've actually seen an increase since we've had to screen for that, and I was wondering what you attributed that to.
I don't know if it's related to that at all. I can tell you that one of the problems with the screening is great, but one of the problems with the screening is, if you all know what a false positive is that if I screen with a test that isn't very accurate, very precise, I'm gonna get a lot of people that answer, that have a condition, or they come out saying they have something, or they're at risk, but it doesn't do me any good, because if I get too many people, then how do I treat all of them? I want to treat the ones that really need treatment. I don't want everybody to come out, you know, with a problem. And a lot of the screening instruments are very sensitive. That means they get everybody who's in trouble, but they also get half the people they get aren't in trouble. So then you don't have enough resources to take care of them. So it's a real dilemma. The most popular of the teen screening things was something from Columbia called Columbia Teen Screen. Sensitivity is wonderful. It's 90%. Specificity is like 40%. Means 6 out of 10 people that they say might be suicidal aren't suicidal. So that doesn't do you any good. Sorry.
Yeah. Do you know what the relationship is between the suicide of a shooter, such as Columbine and all the others we've read about? Is the massacre part of the suicide wish, or is a suicide just incidental in the way out of responsibility? Do you know?
No, it's beyond my pay grade. What do you guys know? No, I really don't know. The other question I was asked as I walked in, and I don't know the answer to this, how this guy did that with the plane the last couple of weeks. Just, I don't understand. I may understand him committing suicide, but killing 150 people at the same time is just, I don't.
At the beginning, you said that preventing suicide saves money.
Yeah.
I can't quite wrap my mind around, in what ways does it save money?
For every person who commits suicide, there's 6 to 10 people whose lives are messed up. So if you just think of the productivity of the family, if you forget that the person, if you take a young person, they don't contribute to society, they don't earn money, they don't pay taxes, they don't do that. But if you just ignore that for the moment, it's the impact on the community and family is tremendous. It really has an impact. It has an impact on everybody. And that's so when people start looking at all the economic implications, if it has major implications to the society.
Okay, I had something to kind of comment off of one of the women who had stood up earlier. As a teacher, I feel like I definitely see some of these labels like bullying or suicide. And I think kind of like you mentioned with the guy, excuse me, at the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, they're putting those labels on themselves to attract like a peer group, and people want to run to them, and now they have this group of friends, and kind of out of a negative, you know, source. So I feel like I do see that a lot. I have another question, kind of something that happened, you know, recently. I'm still teaching. Sometimes I feel like even the counselors are putting labels of suicide on the kids, and I have this young lady in my class who, as she's opened up to me, would rather have the gender as a male. But they've sent her into like the hospital and a clinic and for suicide, and kind of through her poetry, she kind of told everything to me. So, I mean, how do you handle those things when someone comes in, especially kids, with they're changing their gender, I've seen a huge difference in how she's acted when she is now he and as Matthew. She's totally changed. And sometimes I think, like, all year, like, I didn't have the training in something like that, you know, to see it. And she was labeled with suicide and the cutting. So I don't know if that has anything to do with your program that you're in, your triage.
So you're talking about transgendered male?
She's a young woman who's wanting, would rather have, yes.
Yeah, transgender male. It's, there are higher risk for suicide because of the non-acceptance of where they're at with that. And we're so new in that area. Yeah. We have a person in our group with Madison Avenue that actually has a group in town that does the treatment for those folks. So it might behoove you to get a hold of me and I can get you in contact.
Yeah, I'd like to. I know I've been letting her sign her, or sign his papers as Matthew.
Yeah.
And Matthew will raise his hand and answer questions. And I'm like, there's nothing in my, my university that ever prepared me for that. You know, and I've just been going through it the best I can, and him as well, so.
What upsets them the most is the their non-acceptance. So instead of, it'd be good to just continue to call them Matthew rather than to continue to try to go the other way where they're transgendered male, then to use the female name. So that's more acceptances that you can do, the better, to reduce the risk.
Okay, thank you.
We had a woman as part of our committee, and I don't think she's still coming anymore, who represented, I always get the initials wrong, I can never get the initial. Anyway, the lesbian gay community on the suicide prevention committee and was trying to make everybody very conscious of issues of not pointing fingers, etc. You know, you remind me of something else I didn't say before. My ideal, is not only to do what we're doing, which is trying to have programs in place and train clinicians to deal with people as they are today and adolescents as they are today. But my ideal is to go back to fourth, fifth, sixth grade, third grade, second grade, kindergarten, and do the character education anti-bullying start at the beginning. You can't necessarily replace family values for families that aren't intact, and we're in a community with a lot of families that aren't intact, but you can provide a lot of that support if you have the resources and the will to go into school settings. And I've been doing a little bit of stuff with that for years. I really think you need to start at the beginning, because you teach the kids that bullying isn't acceptable from the beginning. You don't start when they're 14 and they've come up for, you know, 10 years of learning they have to bully to get along. That doesn't work. You're always behind the eight ball when you start there. Anyway, thank you guys. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Stan. That was really great. And
well, thank you for listening to tonight's show. We've been listening to Dr. Stanley Yedlovich, professor of psychiatry at UMKC School of Medicine, talking about links between negative thought patterns and clinical symptoms as indicators for acute suicide risk. Tonight's program was recorded on Sunday, April 26th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thanks to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help in producing this program each week. The theme music you are listening to is composed especially for this program by Kansas City artist, composer, and pianist Fred Potter. Don't forget that you can access this program and other programs from the All Souls Forum on KKFI's website at www.kkfi.org. There is a long list of links to previous All Souls broadcasts, and this one will be up within a week from tonight's broadcast. Tune in again next Wednesday at 6 p.m. for another All Souls Forum right here on KKFI. We'll see you then.